is totally embroiled in Ukraine war, but what would prevent them in the future, now that we have established a system in which if you have the power, you could do anything you want? We are literally creating an unsafe world. We are basically fundamentally ripping the world from any system, any safety mechanism that would prevent the powerful from exploiting their power and expanding and subjugating others to their own dictates and interests.
You are listening to an extended conversation with Atif Kabirsi, Professor Emeritus of Economics at McMaster University. Israel-USA's assault on Iran was and is flagrantly unlawful, a clear breach of Article 2 of the United Nations Charter, the collapse of the post-World War II international legal order, the ruination of international humanitarian and human rights law, does not keep Western leaders awake at night. For leaders like Mark Carney, an international banker, it's the disruption of global supply chains and the untrammeled trade in fossil fuels and other lucrative global commodities, not the collapse of the UN system and its charter, that matter the most. Back to our conversation with Atif Kabirsi.
People are saying that Iran has achieved a strategic victory over the United States, that Iran has totally turned the table on the United States and has seized the initiative, and now it is in a position of actually dictating terms to the most powerful nation on earth. Do you subscribe to this view?
Not really. I tell you what. I mean, look, definitely we have to take the fact that the United States was not able to, subjugate or to win this war over Iran. Iran still have a huge capacity of firing ballistic missiles, and the regime is really the same. I mean, the Ayatollah still thinks. I don't think so. But we also need to see the fact that, yes, Iran has been able to withstand all this pressure, all this destruction, but it has survived incredible amount of destruction. Iran's industries have been destroyed. Iran's infrastructure has been destroyed. Iran's, lives under the threat of maybe losing what is the world resource. I mean, if you destroy all its oil and gas, you're denying the world from these things. But the issue here is there is no way, and it was good that Iran was able to withstand the pressure and the push from the U.S. and Israel. But they suffered a lot, and we don't want really a situation in which these countries would have to fend for themselves and, attack their neighbors in the Gulf in order to protect themselves. We'd have completely ripped the world from the mechanism that could have really dealt with this major infraction and this crime against international law, international order, and the civilian people. We have literally denied the people, especially of the global south, from any protection and any meaningful mechanism that would hold those who have imposed on these people the huge cost of destruction and killing of people and children and women. Where is the accountability? And Iran has withstood these onslaughts, but it has paid a big price.
Who are the leaders, who are the statesmen who give you hope these days in the world today? Who's providing leadership? Who's providing courageous, principled leadership, if anyone? And I'm wondering what you think of Mark Carney. I would not place him in that category of leaders, but we can talk about Mark Carney, but who are the leaders who inspire you and excite you today when you listen to them and see them?
Yeah,
I mean, it's Felipe Sanchez in Spain. But yeah,
I would put this
what's
Spanish.
Spain? Yeah. Tell me who inspires you.
Well, I would say Spain has really taken a very honorable position, but unfortunately, not many. I would put Carney has really withstood the pressure to join the U.S. He's really also, through that fantastic speech he gave at Davos, gave us a chance to see that the system is defunct. The international order is not really working properly. But honestly, if there is anything that one can regret and can point to, is the absence of that political leadership in the world that would adhere to international law, to principle, to basic human rights. There is a devoid, and despite all the great things that our prime minister mentioned about the soft powers getting together, where are the soft powers?
But he didn't talk about the United Nations Charter. He didn't talk about the four Geneva Conventions. He didn't talk about the international humanitarian and human rights law. What Mark Carney talks about and received kudos for extolling is what he calls the rules-based international order, which is an entirely mercantile, trade-based concept. That for Mark Carney, the problem is that, you know, money is not flowing as smoothly and as easily as it should be, and we need to restore legal frameworks surrounding the free movement of capital and commodities. He's not talking about the United Nations Charter.
I agree with you totally on this. I would have liked.
And so in this sense, Carney seems to me to be, I mean, he's a banker. He's a really brilliant man. But he's, I would say, I don't know, maybe it's unfair to say, but he seems to be unprincipled.
I would have liked to see our prime minister stand on the side of international law, on the side of international justice, on the side of peace making. I am a little bit worried that even somebody as our prime minister has not found it in his way of thinking and in the way he analyzes things, that what we need is to rehabilitate, is to re-empower, to reinvigorate the UN. He's talking about the soft powers getting together. But wait a minute. What about the UN? Why isn't the UN now the focus of attention and trying to re-empower it, give it some teeth, and give it all the resources and the wherewithal so that it can replay the role that it was conceived for what it is, which is peace and security and human rights and the protection of the environment.
But Carney is now spearheading some brand new idea, something called the Defense, Security and Resilience Bank, which Carney and the Canadian government want to have established its headquarters in Toronto. Have you heard about this Defense, Security, and Resilience Bank?
Yeah.
There's 18 countries coming together to establish this thing. It's a new multilateral financial institution that will bring together like-minded partners to mobilize and deploy private capital and support collective security by providing, facilitating long-term, low-cost financing for defense, security, and resilience initiatives. It all sounds so smooth. It'll be an important new tool to strengthen collaboration with allies and like-minded partners on defense and security, and support member states in bolstering supply chains. It's basically building the global arms industry.
Yeah. No, I mean,
And it's all based on this idea that Europe, because, you know, Carney and Canada are facing Europe as part of NATO, and their whole idea is not that we've got to restore the United Nations Charter and rebuild the United Nations and restore respect for its canonical instruments, starting with the Charter itself. No, the greatest challenge is not dealing collectively with climate change, which is you know, a terminal threat to humanity.
Existential.
It's dealing with Russia. It's facing the malign threat that Russia poses, and China. China's a little bit more polite and genteel than Xi Jinping, than Putin. But this is the idea. This is what we've got to bolster, not our ability to decarbonize, not to build more resilient cities that can resist, you know, climate change and be more just and equitable. It's building up our increasing defense expenditures.
Yeah, I take exception. I'm an economist, but I don't believe that you solve problems with money and finance. The issues are far deeper, far more comprehensive, and require some very structured and organized strategic choices. Money is important, but it's not the thing. Money for what? For building infrastructure and buying more weapons? No, I mean, the issue is far more serious than this. If there is anything to build resilience, anything to improve our ability to cope with all these forces that are tearing asunder our rules-based world and rules, world that is rules of justice, rules of standard morality and respect of human rights and protection of the environment. I find very much the situation is lacking. We need resources, we need commitment, we need creating coalitions, but not just to raise money and spend it on weapons and matters, material matters. We need really to reestablish the world order that's based on a UN system capable of adjudicating all the issues and rip from all this commandeering by the five permanent members that have hijacked the UN Charter to their interests. We need basically and fundamentally to reestablish the rule of law, the rule of justice, the rule of human rights, the rule of protection of the environment. These are the mandates of the UN, and its absence is allowing all these highly valued endeavors and principles to be sidestepped and emasculated.
I mean, you have to have vision. You have to have imagination. You've got to have vision, and you've got to found your approach on. You got to pursue common decency and justice, and you've got to have wisdom, and you've got to have courage. And you have to have all these things before you decide. Let's raise money. Let's establish an international global bank that we can funnel money into. Whatever, you've got to have a vision for what you want to funnel your money into.
Yes, and you've
got to have a vision of development. Like, how can human society develop and proceed forwards into the next 100 years without a vision?
Vision and principles. I mean, what we are really living in is a world devoid of principles. And the principles are not very complicated. Principle of justice, principle of equity and equality, a principle of non-discrimination, principle of survival in a peaceful and with conformity of protecting our existence. Today we are literally fouling the environment in a way that we might be undoing our ability to live in a sustainable life. I mean, what guarantees do you have that if we continue go with the global warming, that we would not have floods where countries and islands would disappear? What guarantee do we have that we would not have catastrophic environmental events that would take the world? What guarantees do we have that one country does not use the ultimate weapon of nuclear things to settle its differences? We need to restructure the world with a vision based on justice, on peace, on human rights, on protection of the environment, and on the supremacy of international law.
And Palestine seems to be a nexus. It seems to be a a kind of a coalescing point. It's like it's a situation that seems to exemplify everything that's wrong with the international political and legal order today. That the things that are happening to Palestinians can be dispossessed. They can be the victims of genocide and apartheid and settler colonialism, like 75 years after the UN Charter, and nobody cares.
Nobody
people like
cares.
Us cares.
You see, nobody cares. This word is extremely important, David. What is, like, I am from Lebanon, you know, came to Canada and happy I came here, but I care about our people there. People are over there saying, look, there's a country invading us. They're bombing every part of Beirut and the mountain, and the pretext is Hezbollah, but they're killing people like they...
And with complete impunity.
Yeah, I mean, they destroyed a building that I have an apartment in, that my dad was living there, and it's in the Christian quarter, had nothing. There is no chance anybody from Hezbollah would be there. Look, the issue here is everybody is raising their hands and saying, why is the world so quiet? Why is the world is allowing this? Why isn't there any reaction to this? Why isn't anybody trying to do something to stop it? With the absence of... you know, our friend in Spain and maybe few countries there, nobody is raising any objection. They're sitting on the sidelines watching. We are permissible. This really incredible attitude of permissibility that would allow the powerful to impose their will on the weak and to kill and destroy at will without any accountability. I mean, this is a world you can't live in. It's not a sustainable world. It's not a just world. It's not a workable world.
Do you still teach?
I don't teach as much as I would like to.
Because, the question I'm getting at is, what are your students like? I presume you still interact with students.
I do. And one thing I really liked, I don't know if you heard about this, Dave, but my students got together and collected money and created a scholarship here at McMaster in my name. And I maintain a good relationship with them. I learn from them now.
What do you learn?
I learn, for example, I have students who are writing on natural capital. A student, natural capital, and the way that if we do not respect and protect our environment, we are basically not only threatening our existence and survivability, but we are also going to be an impoverished world. Why? Because the environment is capital, not in terms of money, but in terms of a system and an empowering mechanisms and resources that allow us to continue to live.
I mean, it's the only capital that really means anything. It's fresh air that we can breathe.
Yeah,
it's
exactly.
Water that we can drink. It's soil that's fertile within which we can grow crops. It's biological diversity.
Exactly.
This is real capital. The rest is just imagination.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you could have all the money capital in the world, but you don't exist even to do anything. Look, survivability, existence, and able to breathe, able to drink clean water, making sure that you are not flooded, making sure that we are able to enjoy the fruits of nature. I mean, these are far more fundamental than all the money. All the money you have, you could burn it. It would not mean anything. But if you burn the environment, you have nothing.
And this is the sort of stuff that your students are teaching you. I'm sure you know about these things, but these are the kinds of things that interest your students that you're talking about with them.
Because they're working and they're doing fantastic work and they're publishing things in top journals and they're advising governments on this. And I have students, too, that are, you know, which is really nice, writing things about... food security. People don't tend to take food security as if it's an issue, but it is. You know, today, if we don't have affordable fertilizers, we might really not get food in the next season. Today is the day where you literally use fertilizers in the fields so that you grow the new crops. So if you have no new crops, where else are the people going to find food? Look, there are certain fundamental questions that we are neglecting. And all these things, unfortunately, are not complex. They're really very, very, very real.
They're totally basic.
Basic. And as we said, it's issues of survivability. It's issues of existence, existential. And we're talking about defense and money we need to spend in order to buy war material. No, this is the time to protect the environment. This is the time to ensure that it is a livable planet. You can't do business on a dead planet. And they have to get it through their brains. And this is a fundamental thing. The economy is not independent of the environment. The economy can only be based on a working, living environment.
I'm not sure how excited Mark Carney would be about that idea.
Well,
he's the banker. He was former Bank of Canada, the chairman, the former Bank of England chairman. And yet what inspires him is building up Canada's defense industrial base. It's not becoming a world leader in decarbonizing the planet in alliance with China, which is way in the lead.
He had ideas in the past, and I remember him being taking pride of being in defense of the environment, but the recent thing he's doing are not consistent with that. And what worries me is that our economic problem that he read well, and justifiably so, is being able to live without being totally, exclusively dependent on the American economy. So his focus, his attention is now diverted towards the jobs of the future and getting a viable Canadian economy. But I still believe, and I hear you saying exactly the same thing, we agree totally, you cannot have a viable economy if you don't have a viable environment. We need to make sure we protect the environment. We make sure that we have a livable environment. We have to make sure we have a clean environment, because an economy cannot substitute for the living environment. And the economy could be more empowered, could be more viable if the environment is viable.
So getting back to Antonio Gramsci's quote, Professor Cabersi, the old world is dying. The new world struggles to be born. This is the time of monsters. Are you hopeful that you will see this new world born before you shuffle off this mortal coil? I could say the same thing about myself.
I'm not hopeful. You know, I'm worried. I'm really worried. I look around, I see people more concerned about wars and trying to survive, and I see the issue about how much am I paying for my gas and things, instead of really looking and see how can we ensure that we have for our children and grandchildren a livable environment. I'm worried.
Does anything give you hope?
Well, I think hope is necessary. You can't live without hope. But I like the hope to be grounded in reality, in understanding the challenges, in appreciating the constraints, and working towards a cooperative solution where we, the people who are trustees on this world and environment, are able to work it together and to make sure that it exists and it is viable for our grandchildren.
Professor Atif Cabersi, thank you so much for joining me on the Green Planet Monitor.
My pleasure. I'm so glad to be with you, David.
Is there anything I didn't ask that you were just waiting for me to ask?
No, I mean, actually, we covered quite a bit of subjects. But what's more interesting is the fact that we are both very much concerned about justice, about international law, about survivability of the environment. And these are very important values that we should, and principles and objectives. And we see in the war and in the current environment nothing to give us the hope that we will be able to achieve these things. And that's why we have to keep discussing, keep voicing our concerns and challenging our leaders and our societies to make sure that the priorities and their vision about the future is consistent with peace and justice and survivability.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Atif Kabirsi is Professor Emeritus of Economics at McMaster University and the President of Econometric Research Limited. Since joining the United Nations Industrial Organization as a Senior Development Officer in 1982, Kabirsi led missions to Indonesia, Thailand, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Sudan, and Egypt. In 2006, he was appointed Executive Secretary of the United Nations Economic and Social Commission for Western Asia. Professor Kabirsi has published extensively on macroeconomics, economic development strategies, international trade, and regional planning centering around the environment. We'll post our conversation with Atif Kabirsi at greenplanetmonitor.net. That's it for today's GPM, a joint production of Earth Chronicle Productions and 93.3 CFMU-FM, Hamilton, Ontario, Canada. Thanks to our news editor, Kylie Wong. Listen to, read, and watch more Earth stories at greenplanetmonitor.net. You can also support our work there by clicking on the subscribe button. And you can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Blueberry, and on Canada's Harbinger Media Network. I'm David Kattenberg, over and out for now.
Can get is static or variations on the central musical rhythm.
I only wish there was some way we could tell it to shut up. It's driving me crazy. And it keeps getting louder.
We have no way of estimating the volume this creature can produce.
The only logical solution is to listen to CJS at 90.1 FM. They broadcast from Burnaby Mountain in British Columbia. Let's tune in now.
Bird note. Sandpipers, like these sanderlings at the beach, are hunched over, probing industriously, as if drilling for oil. But sandpiper bills are far more than drills. Many sandpipers have sensitive nerve receptors in their bill tips, so they can find unseen prey through touch, odor, and pressure changes. And so, they feed even at night. The variety of bill sizes and shapes among the sandpipers is astounding. The long-billed curlew sports a slender, down-curved bill that may reach 9 inches long. With such a tool, the curlew can probe deeply in the mud for marine worms or snatch a grasshopper from deep in the grass. At the other extreme of bill length, the turnstone lives up to its name. Using its short, stout bill as a crowbar, a turnstone turns aside rocks and mats of dried seaweed in search of small crustaceans. Those sandpipers with long, straight bills, such as dowitchers, are often described as stitching. As the bird probes for food, its beak moves rapidly up and down like the needle on a sewing machine. April brings many thousands of sandpipers to Delaware Bay on the Atlantic coast and Grays Harbor and San Pablo Bay on the Pacific. These and other such wildlife refuges are crucial to the migration of these fascinating birds. For BirdNote, I'm Mary McCann.
Do you like music or do you like technology? Or do you like talking to people? CJSF Radio is the place for you. Here at CJSF, the opportunities are endless. You can interview artists and bands, speak up for what you believe in, or even host your own show and tons more. To find out more information, visit cjsf.ca.